From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the pages of Bloomberg, where economics writer and professor Noah Smith offered a warning. Smith says it's gotten too hard to strike it rich in America. That's the title of his piece, in which he explains how many of the traditional ways of accumulating wealth are out of reach for most people. First of all, the data. A 2017 study by the Federal Reserve Bank out of Cleveland found that the probability that a household outside the top 10% getting into the top 10% was twice as high a generation ago as it is now. People aren't really moving up, in other words. And then Smith breaks down the traditional paths to wealth, such as starting a business. Fewer people are doing that, and big corporations are gobbling up the resources and the opportunities. How about flipping houses? You can do that, but after the crash a decade ago, the bulk of home flippers are people who are already rich. Work hard? Yeah, go for it. But while executive pay increases, worker pay stagnates. Smith concludes, quote, without the promise that bold risk-taking and or hard work can make them rich, what will young Americans do with their restless ambition? Many will keep working hard and be willing to accept the paltry returns, but an increasing number will turn against the system itself. Don't be surprised if socialism or other anti-capitalist ideologies become the next hot growth industry, end quote. Smith, by the way, is not endorsing socialism per se. He's observing that a system of capitalism that produces this kind of income inequality is built to fail. Our guests have a range of experiences and views on that, and we welcome in studio Andrew Brady, who's the co-founder of the Rochester chapter of Conscious Capitalism and president and chief evolutionary officer of the Accelerate team. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Also with us is Stephen Brower, an English professor at St. John Fisher College, who also, among his many other teaching activities, teaches about the wealth gap and the American dream. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Jay Levine is with us in studio. Jay is an entrepreneur, a small business owner, and a political consultant. Welcome. Nice to have you here.
Great to be here.
So I'm going to start with you, Andrew, because when you talk about conscious capitalism, what Smith is really doing right now is sort of indicting what capitalism has wrought in the current iteration of it. Is it fair?
You know, the current iteration, I think, is the term that's most important there, because I think that actually, I don't know if anyone saw the Business Roundtable. It's a large organization that's basically a lobbying group of some of the largest Fortune 500 CEOs. Just last week, they came out basically saying when they started, they had a more stakeholder view of capitalism. They shifted along with Milton Friedman and all of those in the 70s and 80s to a purely stockholder focused view, and they basically step back and notice the error in their ways, and they've you know, as many you know have noted, they still have a long way to go to actually live it, but now is the time to start to hold them more accountable to a more conscious form of capitalism that's more purpose driven and that balances the needs of all the stakeholders rather than prioritizing the stockholders above the rest.
So you are sanguine about at least the rhetoric coming from those executives.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because I don't know if you read from the New York Times, I'm sure you did, from Nicole Hannah-Jones. She talked about with the 1619 Project, and she talked about basically how with Black Americans, basically that all of the things that we espoused in the Declaration of Independence was not truly lived, and still to this day is not truly lived in terms of everyone having that opportunity. And I think that similarly, when we're talking about you know capitalism, well, similarly now basically what she said was that Black Americans are most responsible for making America. They're the most American because they've made Americans more responsible to living up to those founding ideals. And similarly, now that this stake in the ground has been publicly stated by these large CEOs, you know, now it's time that the most American thing we can do is to hold them accountable to that.
The Color of Law is a book by Richard Rothstein, which we had Rothstein on the program last month, devoted an entire program to the subject of wealth accumulation and the denial of the ability of African-American families to accumulate wealth in this country via policy, starting at the federal level, all the way down to the way banks behave in local neighborhoods and the creation of redlining and everything else. It's worth going back to listening because that is a great example of how wealth accumulation can be denied entire populations. It's already happened. What Smith is now saying is this is outside of the traditional struggles along racial lines. This is just about concentration of wealth in the hands of a few and what that means. Stephen Brower, you know, you reached out to me briefly when Noah Smith's thread came out, and you said, look, you talk to students about this. How aware are they of the challenge they're going to have to build wealth?
I think they're fairly aware. And so I can only talk from my own experience teaching at Fisher, understanding that my students are a particular type of population that might be different than, say, students at U of R or RIT, and they're usually in somewhat different circumstances. I speak about college loans in every course I teach. They are aware that they have debt coming. I don't know if they always know what that math actually adds up to, but almost a very large percentage of my students have student loans, even while getting a fair amount of financial aid. They have some awareness, I'd say, of what they might make when they come out of college for early income, though usually they've inflated it quite a bit, and they're shocked if I tell them what I make because they just couldn't imagine that that's as little as I make. But I'm an English professor, after all. I'd say they have some awareness, but real-world understanding, I'm not sure how much. I mean, we do something really every semester where we talk about what does it mean to work hard and how, you know, do you know people who work hard? How many people do you know who work 35, 40 hours a week? They have some awareness, but my students even, I'd say there's a diversity, and they're very aware of that diversity in terms of class. It's something we don't talk a lot about on my campus or on many campuses. And it's something I think we need to do. But they're aware of who has a car, what type of car that is, who wears these types of clothes. I'm sure you, or Andrew, were able to discern these things in school. And they recognize that that leads to other possibilities. And we talk a lot about that. And I'm at a school where students and families are very concerned about how this education is going to lead to a particular type of career. And almost all my students are looking for that foothold in the middle class. That's why they're at Fisher. And we have to respect that. A lot of what I'm teaching is in some ways related to what Andrew's talking about in terms of how is the system that they are trying to join perhaps limiting what they can do when they get there. And that's a hard conversation because they've staked a lot on the notion that this college degree is going to get them there.
Well, on those subjects here, as I turn to Jay Levine, I want to just kind of tick off the list that Noah Smith offers for these paths to wealth. He writes about making money by working hard and getting a top job. He says increasingly that requires a degree from a top school or an advanced degree. And remember, even getting through college is very dependent on how much money your parents have. How about real estate? He says middle-class Americans at least know how to play that game, but many were crushed in the crash a decade ago. House flipping is still around, but thanks to tighter lending standards and the entry of institutional investors into the housing market, even house flipping is increasingly a game for those who already have a lot of money. How about investing in other people's businesses? If you bet big on Google or Amazon stock, you'd have a lot of money by now. But most people who play that game lose. So stock investing is taken over by institutions. And the classic way to get rich, start a business. But fewer people are starting businesses per capita. Big chains have been muscling out local businesses, closing off an essential route into the upper middle class. Big corporations are taking over, end quote. Jay, we were talking briefly yesterday, and if you could, I'd like to kind of explore your own story, because you mentioned something that struck me, is that when you were in college, your view on what the economy was and sort of how it would function is maybe fundamentally different than what you've encountered. Tell me about that.
Well, I think a lot of it will just sound familiar to people, that the opportunity to create wealth as an entrepreneur is clearly not as good as it used to be, just because the access to capital isn't necessarily what it used to be. And a lot of people never really had that access to capital. And that's why I actually wanted to preface anything about my own story, and that I'm not complaining, because I view my own story through the prism of recognizing I had certain advantages that most people did not have, that I was able to attend an Ivy League school and have an Ivy League network, that my family was certainly not a family of means, but at the same time, I was in a position that I was never going to starve, that if I had a child, he's never going to starve. And that allowed me to take risks as an entrepreneur that a lot of Americans would not be able to take those risks or have access to those kinds of contacts. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm complaining when I state it. But so when I look at my story and I say, all right, I've done okay, but it's been challenging. And particularly the challenge has been to reach a point of real economic security to build wealth. Again, not just to get by, not just to do pretty well, but to actually build wealth if you are successful. And I feel that, obviously, I know many people from college who've been professionally successful, but building wealth is something different. Achieving economic security is something different. And I know that there's not a lot of sympathy, perhaps shouldn't be a lot of sympathy for this out there. But the reality is, people, I think, would we all agree that if somebody has a household where they're making $200,000, that would generally be considered successful by most people's standards.
Yeah.
However, people who have a $200,000 household, by and large, do not feel they have any real economic security. They do not feel that they have the ability to retire with economic security, having sent their children to college, which are, these are just basic benchmarks for American success. And that has largely gone away. And there's a combination of reasons for it. But one of the main reasons that struck me as everyone was making their comments earlier was simply that the incentive for companies to employ people in highly compensated positions over the long term has almost entirely gone away. And we saw that creeping down through the 90s and the aughts, the early 2000s. But to me, there was a sea change with the 2008 crash in that companies decided that they now had license to just purely contract employ as many people as they possibly could in a sort of shameless way. And I think there was sort of a degree of shame associated
with... No benefits.
Right.
Poor pay, yeah.
So that even people who are rather highly skilled in the job market, you know, we talk about the gig economy. You know, I have a lot of great gig economy skills. It still doesn't add up to economic security, though. And that's, I think that is a big difference between now and the economy that we expected coming out of college in the 90s. If you are not deliberately... And this was part of our discussion yesterday.
Yeah.
There are people who are obviously born into wealth. There are people who can marry into wealth. That's a strategy. And there are people who can attempt to achieve wealth and build wealth, you know, professionally. And my understanding, looking around at my classmates from the 90s, is that hardly any of them, and there are a couple exceptions sort of in the entertainment industry, but in general, nobody has really been able to build wealth on a professional level in terms of being an entrepreneur or being a highly successful professional unless their goal out coming out of college was simply to pursue wealth, essentially unless they were going into investment banking and at Penn, knowing Wharton students. There were plenty of those people. But if you were not, if your main goal in life wasn't to accumulate wealth, if you were pursuing any other track, the way the economy has gone, you are unlikely to have built much significant wealth.
And when you talked about this originally, I thought, well, that's kind of a tautology. The people who got rich are the ones who tried to get rich. But what actually, I stepped back and I thought, no, that's actually quite a problem. If the only people who can get rich are the ones who are sort of hell-bent on getting rich.
Because that's not the system we were sold.
Right.
We were sold the system that said, essentially, if you were really good at your job and you work hard, if you're a talented person, then you should end up with a basic level of American security. The idea of sending your kids to college and being able to retire with a little bit of economic security, that didn't used to be a fantasy. That didn't used to be like someone who felt like a lottery winner, which younger people may not even understand that. That used to be considered a normal thing, that if you simply worked hard and were good at your job and didn't screw up royally, you were expected to get there. And a lot of people, in fact, basically got there with union jobs. It wasn't even necessarily considered management or high-level professionals who were the only ones who could achieve that. People who just were had any kind of skilled labor and worked hard for a few decades, they were going to achieve those basic things. I don't think anyone thinks that's the case anymore.
So one more. Well, Stephen, you want to jump in there? Go ahead.
Well, that I'd call it the mythos of that American dream. It's very powerful. It's very alluring. It's very hard to talk to young men and women about that in a way that problematizes it in the way you're saying that, because it is so strong in our country, regardless, male, women, black, white, Latino, people believe that and they want to believe it. And the rhetoric surrounding us is very much built into that idea. But as you said, that's just not, I say to my students, do you know people who don't work hard? Pretty much everyone I know works hard. That can't be the end in itself.
Yeah, that is part of the mythology. You know, this notion that people who are out of work, well, if they just worked hard, if they just, you know.
Well, hardly anyone's out of work these days.
Yeah.
I'm just saying the actual employment levels are extremely high.
Yeah, but that's artificial, though. How many people are...
They're underemployed.
It's not only that.
And they're vastly underpaid.
It's the people who are even participating in the labor force. Those numbers are pretty low.
Well, but there can be good reasons for that.
Okay.
If people are retiring or disabled or they simply have decided...
Okay, but let's stay on the point that Jay's making here because I want to talk about the implications. The point that Jay's making here is, what does it say if we've got low levels technically of unemployment and yet we have low levels of wealth building? What Noah Smith is saying is, you're in real trouble. That people are going to start to say, maybe socialism is the way to go here. Now, I happen to know that Jay's view is that you think Americans of a certain age are not going to get on board with socialism, and that's a non-starter. So let's talk capitalism here. Do you share the indictment of capitalism from Smith? Not saying capitalism itself is a problem, but this iteration is not sustainable with this wage gap and with the current indicators.
I mean, it depends what you mean by sustainable. If you're saying, you know, is it possible we can just emerge with sort of a feudal system of like the hyper rich people and laborers and people in poverty? I can't say if that's politically sustainable as a society, but I'm not sure that you know, people have, you know, societies have been that way for a long time, you know. So is it? I guess I can't answer the question whether that's politically sustainable.
He's saying socialism is going to be the next growth industry with these indicators. What do you think?
I think it's a long way off because I think socialism is complete. I mean, there's polling on this. Like the last thing anybody wants in a president is a socialist. They did this polling and saying the worst two things a candidate could be in a generic sense without naming specific names are elderly or a socialist. And that's I don't have the data in front of me, obviously, but which, you know, I hate. But the
no, he hates not having the data, not
right,
the data itself.
Right, I hate not having, sorry, yeah, I hate not having the data. I hate being the anecdote guy. But the for people over 35, socialism is such an automatic no that if there's going to be a growth socialism stock, you know, it's hard to believe that it could be in the next 15 or 20 years. There's just too many. I mean, it's just all the baby boomers and all of Generation X are just like socialism. That's obviously not whatever the answer is. It's not that, even though there is, I think, very broad consensus and not even divisive on the political spectrum that the current system is deeply broken and incredibly unfair to almost everybody.
Can I just jump in? I'd say that's partly because most people don't understand what socialism means, nor what it is, because there's lots of socialist policies that actually are quite popular, and a number of candidates
certainly
espousing those in the past presidential
and popular with every generation.
Yes, and especially popular with young people. That's what I see. The policies. Now, the rhetoric around socialism, which is often equated with the Soviet Union, which then I'm always saying, you mean a communist, which might not be the same thing. The rhetoric, especially the political and ideological rhetoric, is very powerful.
So at the risk of asking Andrew to speak for a generation, which you cannot do, but I do want to kind of touch on this aspect that Jay is bringing up here, which is that at least I want to kind of pursue this question of what happens to a society when people who are college-age students, people that Professor Brower is working with, people who are, you know, 20-somethings or 30-somethings now, I think.
Don't tell.
Okay. What happens in a society when there is a collective mindset that even if I work hard, even if I hustle, I'm not going to build wealth. I may never buy a house. I'm not going to have any wealth to pass on to a next generation. I don't know if I can afford to have kids. I can't send my kids to college. What is, if this mindset is taking hold, as Professor Smith says it is, what's the logical next step?
Well, at the individual level, there's actually plenty of research that shows that when people have that, you know, scarcity, they lack the economic security or whatever, that they become even more short-term focused. You know, they did a study basically with farmers, and farmers right after the harvest, when they have a plenty, they actually can think longer term and plan longer term. And when they have a shorter, when they're, you know, the right before the harvest, when they're kind of waiting until the next one, they have a shorter term focus. A book called Scarcity is just phenomenal on kind of the implications of this mindset. But it's basically like it's a tax on your creative bandwidth, your long term thinking and planning. So at that individual level, you think about, well, gosh, when we take away this American dream of the potential not only to do better than your parents, but that things are going to get better in the future. I mean, capitalism is sort of predicated on that system, right? Like, that's the reason why you'd put money away for savings. That's the reason why you'd plan for the future, why you would buy a house. all of those sorts of things. And de Tocqueville, you know, he called the American dream that charm of anticipated success. Mm-hmm. And so when we lose that charm, we start to behave differently. But then at the societal level, another great book, it's quite a thick one, but Why Nations Fail, talks about this interplay between both the economic system and then the government system. And essentially what happens is that when the economic system becomes more and more extractive, then the people with that money and wealth try to accumulate power, and then they create more and more extractive political systems. And that's essentially just a ratchet effect. And that's why, you know, they trace you through. That's why Rome fell. And that's why, you know, all these empires of the past fell. And in the alternate way to go about it is to create more inclusive both economic systems and then also more inclusive democratic systems where everyone's voice is heard. And I think part of the reason, the reason the Business Roundtable, you know, they started to walk back some of the things that they've been doing for a while, is we need to, you know, I'll call it an enlightened self-interest, right? They're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. I don't technically believe, but you know, as Nick Hanauer talks about, he's got a great Pitchfork Economics podcast.
You're wearing a Pitchfork shirt.
I am.
Is that a Nick Hanauer shirt?
Yes,
it is.
and big fan. Anyways, I you know, he's basically, he talks about, he has Pitchfork Economics, basically that if the pitchforks are coming, and I think that those people of the Business Roundtable start to see that when they see the political rhetoric and all those sorts of things. So it's our kind of duty almost as Americans to hold them accountable to a more inclusive form of capitalism, because, you know, I think that one of the things that happens, you know, there's two ways that you can make money in an economic system. One is to actually create something of value, and the other is to kind of hold on to something that already exists. And what they call that rent seeking in economic terms. And when you are rent seeking, that's, you know, the lobbying that you try to do to put up barriers so that your company can succeed and there can't be new startups. And the more money that gets accumulated, the more rent seeking happens. You mentioned the feudal order before. You know, that's the whole reason we have castles and moats. You know, eventually you can spend your money, and rather than continuing to build something of value, you can instead just start digging your moat. And digging that moat around, you know, your company and or your, you know, individual wealth. And the greater that inequality becomes, the more incentive there is to build a taller wall and a deeper moat, because you want to make sure that, you know, you can keep your money. You want to make sure that the next generation can keep their money, all those sorts of things.
That's what Hanauer says. Hanauer is a billionaire who says guys like me are going to have pitchforks coming, if not for. But he's not for saying, if not for socialism. He's talking about a kind of capitalism that, yes, I know, Andrew and his chapter support. So let me get some listener feedback, because we've already got a bunch here, and I haven't even mentioned the phone number. Listeners, if you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 844-295-8255. Whether you're in Rochester, Philadelphia, or an LGT old head, or wherever you're listening, anywhere in the country or internationally, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Rick, first on the phone. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much. First of all, I'm happy to hear this show. I happen to think that income disparity in this country is possibly the biggest solely domestic issue that we have going at the moment. At the same time, I'm curious, you know, I was comparing in my head 40 years ago, you know, bringing up the union worker of 40 years ago and sort of expectations there. And what I realize is, this is sort of for me, a running theme throughout our history, is that expectations are rising as fast as anything else is rising. So that, the person who was retiring at 50 years ago, you know, as a salesperson from, an unnamed sales company, wasn't expecting 30 years of retirement that included a place in Florida, right? Like that we've normalized that sort of, you can retire in Naples to still have three decades of healthy, wonderful time before you're put in a home, and that just isn't a reality. And back then they didn't expect that. Their retirement included a little bit of travel and basically, you know, quite a bit of freedom with their time, but didn't include, except for the very wealthy, didn't include, you know, what we now picture as retirement. A lot of people now picture as retirement. I just want to know about changing expectations and how you think that plays into it.
Thank you, Rick. I mean, are you ever going to retire?
No, I don't know hardly anyone who's ever going to retire unless they already have wealth. You know, I appreciate the caller's comment, but it's honestly think it's irrelevant because the reduced expectations are not achievable. If we could say it's not supposed to be 30 years and it's not supposed to be a home in Florida, you can't retire in your own reasonably priced hometown where you are now for 15 years. You can't retire at all. So I'm not saying he's wrong that the expectations have increased to an extent, but also that might be that a generational thing. It might be that baby boomers' expectations increased, but I guarantee you millennials don't have those expectations, and Generation X has had a rude awakening that we're going to be more like the millennials than like the baby boomers.
Okay. Stephen, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd be interested in sort of the data about expectations. That's certainly interesting. I don't really imagine retiring, but that's because I love my work, and I don't know what I would do with myself exactly. But you know, one thing that comes to mind, income disparity is certainly an issue, but really we're talking about wealth disparity, which is much more substantial and much more systemically problematic. And it cuts across things like gender, but certainly, as we've mentioned, race and ethnicity in ways that are so striking when you see those charts. It feels unethical. It feels immoral.
It's shocking.
Yeah.
I think even people with a very conservative outlook would find those charts shocking, just how huge the wealth disparity is demographically across racial lines, across, you know, all kinds of lines.
So I'm going to become a professor real quick. John Winthrop, who was one of our earliest settlers in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, wrote an essay, gave a speech on the boat over the Arbella called The Model of Christian Charity. And I talk about this in my classes as the first articulation of the American dream. And Andrew, you were talking about economics and government. And of course, they were forming a government in this colony, and he ended up being the head of it. For him, it was all based on the Bible. And you used the word duty. In fact, if you reread that essay, the word duty shows up repeatedly. The Puritans believed in profit. They believed in the value and that it meant something. It represented something. But in this speech he gave to them, he talked about the duty of the people who do well. They are obligated in their belief, through their belief system, to provide charity and help to anyone who asks for it ever. And in fact, he also articulates, if you don't do that, you will fail. We all will fail, and we will be condemned for it, obviously, both morally speaking, religiously speaking, but also as an example. This is the speech in which he coined the phrase city upon a hill, which is often misunderstood when you read the actual essay, because it's not we are the beacon of the world. In fact, the way he articulates it, and it's near the very end of the speech, it's that everyone is watching us. We are on trial. And if we fail to live up to those duties, those obligations to our fellow citizens, if people are failing, we all fail, and our whole system, our whole faith system, our whole economic system will fail. So it's not quite the, hey, we're the best. It's actually, we are always being judged. Always.
And that was Winthrop, you say, right?
Yes, John Winthrop.
So that's Winthrop. And so, Andrew, when we talk about what it's going to take to change that concentration of wealth, the writer Anand Giridharadas says he doesn't believe we're getting, quote unquote, out of this situation, this structural imbalance that, as Jay says, is sort of obscene or, immoral, shocking perhaps even to anybody, no matter your political stripes. Giridharadas says we're not getting out of this unless some people get hurt. And he's not talking physically, but he's talking about enough of this zero-sum game, good for everybody. The people at the top have to take a little bit of a hit. And that's why he thinks that maybe this change of systems, and again, not necessarily capitalism, though perhaps, is going to be a lot more difficult because this is not a zero-sum, this is a zero-sum game, and this is not a rising tide that lifts all boats. Do some people have to take a hit?
You know, I think maybe in the short term it feels that way, but I've seen all kinds of studies. I don't have the numbers in front of me.
I knew you were going to do this. You're going to say, no, it's good for everybody.
Well, I don't have the numbers.
Right.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but you can. There's all kinds of studies in terms of if we were to eliminate the wealth gap among races, or we were able to eliminate the pay gap, you know, the male female pay gap, all those sorts of things. The ways that it would grow the economy, and a big part of that is because when you give people, you know, the reason Henry Ford, you know, increased wages was so that people could afford to buy the cars. And similarly, you know, when you give money to people who don't have enough right now, they're going to spend it. They're going to grow the economy. Whereas when you give the money to the, you know, to the richest, they often rather, like I said earlier, rather than spending their money to build something,
money doesn't circulate.
They start digging their moat.
That's right. But maybe the better argument, at least to my ears, is, and I think this is what Hanauer says: you can make $1 billion for 10 years. Or you can make $50 million in perpetuity, because option A is not sustainable and it's all going to crash down.
Exactly.
If you're not careful. You can still be rich in perpetuity as long as other people can get rich. And you may not be as rich as you were, but you can sustain it. That's his argument.
I think it's true at the country level. I think it's something that I try to, especially with our local Conscious Capitalism chapter, try to really focus on. Because if the prosperity is not inclusive for everyone, it won't be sustainable. You know, when you stop building and you start digging a moat, you aren't actually growing the economy in a way that it can happen for everybody. And actually, you know, one of the things I think that also needs to kind of get dismantled from, you know, this current form of capitalism, it's funny because I think we don't give Adam Smith enough credit. He was much wiser than the ways that people talk about him today. In terms of when you're talking about, you know, everybody, free markets and get rid of regulation and all those sorts of things. And when Adam Smith talked about free markets, he wasn't talking about free from regulation. He was talking about free from rent seeking, not allowing the moat digging, the lobbying, all the things that people do to try to entrench their power and their wealth. And so, you know, when instead of that, you know, we actually have a different form of capitalism where we get rid of some of that, you know, whether that's getting rid of the money in politics or in all those different sorts of things, you know, it makes a more inclusive economic system, and it also allows more voices to be heard in a truly one person, one vote sort of a way in that political system.
Do you want to add to it? You think that Andrew's right. He says...
Well, two things. One is just to make sure that people understand that part of the connection here is that the more the economy is based on rent-seeking, the more it is tilted towards those who already have wealth, because rent-seeking economic activity is only available to people who already have wealth or who magically have access to a lot of capital without being wealthy, and that doesn't really exist. So go ahead.
I was just wanted to say real quickly, like you had a show on it, I think, a while ago about the people that were spending all kinds of money to get their kids into, you know, the best colleges, right? When the disparities are greater, there's more and more incentive to dig the moat.
Right, right. So, but the larger question that you're getting back to is just this question of, and this is a vast oversimplification, but that's all that's going to do for the moment, is the question of, are you going to have a larger slice of a shrinking pie, or are you going to have a smaller slice of a pie that is expanding? And we know that when, and this is, again, not to confuse income gap and wealth gap, but we know that when the income gap is less, that when income is better distributed, when more people have, when more working people have more money to spend, that the economy is going to grow faster. And there is absolutely no question about that as far as the data is concerned. So if you want to talk about a zero-sum game, the question for those who already have wealth isn't how much wealth am I going to have? Because essentially there is no system we're going to devise except pure socialism that is going to exclude the wealthy from being wealthy. They're going to make money either way. The question is it going to be a smaller slice of a larger pie or a larger slice of a smaller pie? Either way, they're fine. The only real difference is how working people are doing.
Okay, Stephen?
Yeah, no, I think I'm hearing something I would agree with, which is the logic of capitalism is that this is the way that capital moves. It moves up. So controlling the capital is what the goal becomes. And so I agree with Andrew talking about the notion of correctives, right? I think that's what you're talking about. The economic system is what it is. The government, the governing system has the ability to create correctives so that it's more equitable, more just. And we've had that in our history. We certainly have had that one at different points in time. I'll tell you what I do with my students is I ask them all about what happened when they were a kid when they played Monopoly. And Monopoly is an amazingly smart game because it's the accumulation of all the capital, and eventually you squeeze everyone out. And I say to my students, how do you win? They're like, well, you end up with more money. I'm like, no, that's not how you win in Monopoly. You win when you get all the money. all of it. And that's what that logic drives you towards, right? That's when you're being squeezed out. Talk about
rent.
There
is no competition left.
There is no competition left. And this is, I would suggest.
And no customers then, and all kinds of, you know, trickle down.
Right. Is that what success then actually looks like? Yeah. But the logic of that game moves you towards that. And I think it's a very interesting game for children. I said, you know, it was teaching us something. We just didn't know it at the time.
Go ahead, Jay.
Well, and this is why I sort of want to bring it back to the original topic, in a sense, and why I'm sort of focused in a way on the upper middle class, or really what I think of as the middle upper class. And what I mean by that is I've been carefully watching for years this very basic question in my mind, which is, when are the millionaires going to figure out that the billionaires are not on their side? And that revolutions very often occur. Because this is the question, like, if there's really going to be a move towards socialism, or to be honest, even just a move toward repairing capitalism would require a huge shift in certain people's thinking. And revolutions like that often happen, in history, when there's a merchant class that figures out that the very top of the pyramid is taking too much, that essentially they're trying to take everything. And that is the situation we have now. And the question is, how long is it going to take for that information to sort of filter up through our economic classes to the point where the millionaires figure out we need to be on the side of working people rather than on the side of the billionaires? Because the billionaires eventually, just like in the Monopoly game, will not leave anything for the rest of us.
Isn't that the story of the current presidential race?
Absolutely it is. Right. And it's the story of who voted for that person, you know, in certain suburbs.
I think that's a lot of what the debate is going in the
right.
next year
there's,
and a half.
There's still the thought of, well, this guy is on my side
sure.
and not on, you know, the socialist side.
There's actually an interesting story that you can look up around the game of Monopoly where it originally came with two rules.
We did a show on
it. Rules.
Of course we did a show on it.
Yeah.
We've done a show on everything.
And there's two sets of rules. And, you know, one set of rules was all around, basically the way that it is now. But there's another set of rules where everyone was rewarded when you know, total wealth was created.
It's called anti-Monopoly.
Ah.
That's what it was known as.
Boy, that sounds like socialist.
There was a game that came out in the 60s and 70s called Anti-Monopoly, but the initial game, was created with a very different mindset. So
I feel like there's eventually going to be a congressional panel, you know, quizzing you on that. Have you ever played Anti-Monopoly?
I am very late for our only break of the hour. If you're on the phone, stay there. If you've sent an email, stay there. We've got a lot to talk about. In fact, our guests just started talking politics. And as we talk about economic systems, interestingly enough, we have a presidential campaign in which, on the Democratic side, you do have a Democratic socialist. You also have someone compared to him a lot in Elizabeth Warren, who is a full-throated capitalist, but in favor of regulated capitalism. Well, Andrew Brady is here talking about this issue and more. He's the co-founder of the Rochester chapter of Conscious Capitalism. Jay Levine is an entrepreneur, a small business owner, and a political consultant. Stephen Brower is an English professor at St. John Fisher College, and your feedback is next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections. In our first hour, a conversation about the implications of Andrew Luck. Will this be a spark for change? Will more people retire, or perhaps more kids decide not to pursue football at all? Then in our second hour, Joywave joins us. Take a look at their new music video for a song called Like a Kennedy. What do you think it's all about? We talk about how the public receives art in our second hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A lot of feedback to rip through in the next 15 minutes. So, first of all, Marty says, what happens when there's no hope? It creates a vacuum to be filled by chaos and demagogues. But realities aside, is this where the Republicans are reaching the common American better than the Democrats? Republicans talk about upward mobility, challenges, and personal responsibility. Democrats are concentrated on identity politics and entitlement right now. Jay Levine, are Republicans more effective at talking to working Americans because Democrats are too focused on identity politics and the like?
Geez, I guess I would have to say yes. But I mean, but part of this is I have to say yes because you're not going to find me praising Democrats on the subject of messaging to working people. But having said that, it has to be said that what that feedback is really talking about is white Americans.
Yes.
Because if you look at all working Americans, the Democrats are reaching them just fine. And, you know, the Democrats basically, even in 2016, they were winning working class people. If we're really talking about all working class people,
yep.
Democrats were winning it. Can there be too much of an emphasis on identity politics? Okay, I don't know what too much is, because it's hard to say that that equality and people's rights being, you know, not being trampled, that it's hard to say that those things aren't important. But I think that white working class Americans, maybe, you know what? Actually, I'm going to reject the entire premise. I'm going to say
bad premise.
Democrats aren't reaching those people as well as they should be. But at the same time, the data shows pretty conclusively that economic fears is not what has driven voters to vote Republican and specifically to vote for Trump. And the data is really pretty clear about that.
Professor Brower.
There's also some rhetorical flourishes going on. Was it Marty? So personal responsibility for Republicans or conservatives, and then identity politics. I don't think a lot of Democrats actually I'd say that that's what I'm necessarily for. And then entitlements. I always reject the word entitlements because I feel like actually I've been paying that money for a long time. That's mine. I expect to get it back at some point. It's taken out of, you know, it's like when you get that first check, you're like, who's this FICA guy? And why is he getting some of my money? Even in that is a disparity where I'd say actually what I see the Democrats doing more of, as we just mentioned a few minutes ago, is actually talking about systemic problems with the system that we're having. And they're looking to as you said, Warren identifies as a capitalist, but she is for some of those correctives that Andrew's talking about. Sanders is perhaps a little more left of that in some ways in terms of an overall system.
But don't sell Warren's proposals short on that.
I'm not.
Of her proposals, and particularly with respect to corporate governance, mm-hmm. are dramatic reforms.
Sure.
They are not sort of trimming around, they're not even as mild as Dodd-Frank. They're far more dramatic than Dodd-Frank, for example.
I agree, and I think that's why she's being positioned by the right as a radical and dangerous.
Yeah. Andrew.
Well, she's got her, as the joke goes, she's got a plan for everything, right? Mm-hmm. But one of her plans is around the Accountable Capitalism Act, which, you know, there's a lot to it. But ultimately, I think it's how do we shift this conversation around all regulation being a bad thing?
Right.
Because that's really where we are right now when we celebrate free markets, you know, free of all regulation. And like I said earlier, that's not what Adam Smith was talking about. He was talking about free from rent seeking, which actually looks quite a bit different, because to make something free from rent seeking actually requires quite a bit of regulation. I mean, we all have both altruistic and self-interested tendencies within us, both as individuals, but you can even look at the cellular level. When a cell becomes really self-interested, it grows and grows and multiplies, and we call that cancer, and that leads to the death of the entire system. And so similarly, when we allow, you know, those with power, you know, some small minority to grow and grow and grow at the expense of all else, that's what we were talking about earlier. The pie stops growing and maybe even dies. And so creating, you know, there's all kinds of regulation you may not know, but that happens in our bodies. That cancerous growth happens hundreds, maybe thousands of times a day, but our immune system, you know, kills those cancerous cells. And so we need an immune system in terms of our laws, in terms of our policies that restrict that cancerous growth that is ultimately going to hurt us all. Because, you know, it gets talked a lot. I've always been really uncomfortable with the term of American exceptionalism, because it is like in the way that it's used, I think it's very much of like a chest beating. I was born American, and as we were talking about earlier, that usually means, you know, for the white males, myself included, and that's the kind of American—
And their wives, too.
You know, that's the kind of American exceptionalism that usually comes across. But I think we are exceptional, but what makes us exceptional is that may no longer be true. In fact, there's some studies that show that it's not. But what used to make us exceptional, we certainly weren't the best, or we certainly weren't perfect with inclusion. We certainly weren't perfect with meritocracy, but we're doing it better than anybody else. And now there's other countries, based on their regulations, based on what some would call socialism, but I think it is more of a you know, inclusive prosperity conscious type of capitalism, where there's other countries doing it better than us, and where they have a more meritocratic system, they have more inclusive prosperity, and their pie is going to grow faster. And so when we're thinking about being exceptional, it's not an inborn thing. It's something that not only requires regulation and requires constant tending, but also requires you know, something that, that we can't ever take our eye off the ball.
Briefly, before I jump back to the phones, Jay Levine, as a small business owner, what do you make of Andrew Yang's call for a universal basic income on the grounds that more people are unwilling to take risks and become entrepreneurs because of the current economic state, and that a UBI would be a way to pave the way for at least a little more innovation and entrepreneurialism?
I think that there are a lot of things that can be done to make people feel that they have some base level economic security that makes, you know, entrepreneurialism more attractive. Taking healthcare away from being employer based is the best example. By the way, find me one business owner that wouldn't like all of healthcare off their balance sheet. They all would, because it simply makes it easier to make good business decisions. And why is your employer even involved in that?
Are you saying UBI is probably far down the menu for you in terms of?
I'm not saying it's far down the menu. I'm saying that it's part of an overall menu. I think that the reality is that we face a situation looking into the future where wealth is going to continue to grow as long as the whole system doesn't collapse, which is an if. But as long as, you know, if we assume the system doesn't totally collapse, wealth will continue to grow, but the demand for labor is going to continue to shrink.
All right, we got to keep it tight on the phones. We got a lot of calls. Keith, next. Go ahead, Keith.
Real quick, about wealth or prosperity, a couple of things your guest mentioned was there's a lot of things you can do on a small individual level. Is you don't have children out of wedlock, because that just puts so much weight on your shoulders, and you live beneath your means. A lot of people make good pay and they spend every freaking dime. And the other thing that is disconcerting is a lot of people are wealthy because they make their money off of poor people. And the biggest group of that would be people in the medical field. They make money off of Medicaid.
So Jay, just let me say, like, there's nothing wrong with telling people, here's financial literacy. I mean, Stephen talks about that. Here's what your loan debt's going to mean. Here's what an interest rate actually turns into over time. Mm-hmm. But people are not buying enough avocado toast to prevent them from buying homes. There is a fundamental difference in the way wages are happening in this country versus a generation ago, and it's not just the avocado toast and the extra latte. It's just not. Nothing wrong with financial literacy, right? But it's just
I think the core issue is that what we're talking about today is that even for people who do everything right, that they still are unlikely to achieve any real kind of financial security for them
Noah
and their
Smith
children.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
So I'm not disagreeing, like you said, that, you know, financial literacy is good. Obviously, making responsible decisions is good. But for people who do everything right, we still have a major systemic problem.
Yeah, and it's about accessibility, and that's what that article is a lot about. Who can afford that college and the education and the costs that go with it? Who can afford to invest in the investment firm that can actually create greater wealth? You need to, you know, there's a bar you have to put your money. You have to have enough to put it in. Who can get to the bank? Can you get the loan with what you have to offer to start a business? It's the accessibility is in equitability is I think the word you're talking about is really that. I think those are the heart of the conversation.
Yeah. When you're talking about, you know, regulations and systemic things, at the risk of being a Nick Hanauer fanboy, he talks a lot.
Too late.
He talks a lot about stock buybacks. Stock buybacks were actually illegal until 1982. It was seen as an unfair manipulation of the stock price. And then when we shifted to a stockholder form or a stockholder focused form of capitalism, that became something that was no longer illegal. And then, gosh, what's an easy way? Well, now that we tie executive compensation to the stock price, what's an easy way to manipulate it? Well, we could, you know, go through all the hard work of, you know, creating more value, or we could just, buy back a few shares, bump up the stock price. True. And one of the things he talks about is that $6.9 trillion has been spent on stock buybacks since 2004. And that is 54% of the profits of companies on the S&P 500. And so, you know, the way that we set things up, there was recently Wells Fargo authorized a $40 billion stock buyback. And rather than doing that, they could have instead given to their 262,000 employees, they could have given them each $154,000. So, right. So that's the kind of and when stock buybacks are happening, that manipulation of the stock price, and there's other ways it gets manipulated. You know, you can lay off a bunch of workers, sure, so that you boost your earnings to meet the quarterly numbers and those sorts of things. But every time we do those sorts of things, it especially when I think it's something like, you know, the people with over $100,000 own almost all the stocks. So every time we're bumping up stock price, in some ways we're creating wealth, but it's just concentrating that inequality.
Concentrating. Yes. So in our last minute here, the out-of-towner, I'm going to turn to you for some final thoughts here. People with concentrated power and wealth are pretty good historically about continuing to concentrate and keep it. Where do you think we're going next?
I think, I alluded to it a few minutes ago. I think we're going to a question where the people who are sort of near the top and not at the top have a decision to make about which side that they're on. And what a lot of these topics revolve around, what he's talking about, manipulation of stocks, and also about socialist programs in Europe. And there's sort of this, I don't want to confuse people between a socialist program and a socialist system. And when you hear about any of these things, what you get to is this basic idea of values. When we hear about socialist programs in Europe that seem like they would work just fine here, the reason they don't happen here is that people say, well, that's not what generates the most money, so how could we do that? And because wealth and money are worshipped here, and everything, any kind of behavior, economically or otherwise, is excused as long as somebody was making money, that is taken. And that's a problem with the values in our culture right now.
Hey, thanks for taking the time to be here in your visit to Rochester. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you.
That's Jay Levine, who is an entrepreneur and a small business owner and a political consultant, and Stephen Brower, Professor Brower, going back to St. John Fisher soon, getting
Absolutely.
Ready for the fall. Thank
yes.
you, sir. Thanks for taking
thanks
the time.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Brady, you'll find him as the co-founder of the Rochester Chapter of Conscious Capitalism and the Accelerate team. Thanks, as always. Thanks for being here.
Always a joy. This one was especially fun.
And lots of people to thank this hour. MRA Stein, thank you. Great to have you with us. Bob, volunteering. Barsook Records for the music. Megan Mack, the producer. Rob Braden, the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.